Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Radio Show with host Karen Rands. A compassionate capitalist is someone who invests their money into entrepreneur endeavors to bring innovation to the market, impact their community, create jobs, and generate wealth for all those involved. Karen and her guests share insights and best practices for entrepreneurs to succeed and scale their business and investors to share in that success without all the risks. And now. Yes, welcome back to the Compassionate Capitalist Show. Karen Rands here, and we're going to jump back into talking about things that are near and dear to startups and investors' hearts, right? Everything seems to be about software these days. A lot of companies are developing new software for at all different levels, consumer and enterprise. And one of the big things that, you know, used to always be that the thing that investors struggled with in finding common ground with entrepreneurs was valuation. Now it's what do they have to show in order to prove that their idea is going to work when it comes to software before an investor will invest at that very early stage. And we're going to get into what all that is, the changing landscape, with my special guest today, Edie Welfley, that is to talk about, you know, minimal viable products, MVP. We're going to talk about wireframe and prototyping, the difference of all of that with a beta, a Figma, which is a new term I just learned. And so we're going to jump in all of that. And let me tell you the reason why Edie is the perfect person to talk to us about this. Edie is a skilled solution architect with a passion for implementing the highest quality solutions for startups and emerging growth companies, and the founder of Keyboarder. And that's spelled K-E-I-B-O-A-R-D-E-R, which is also the web thing, keyboarder.com. And so after graduating summa cum laude with a BS in game design and development from Rochester Institute of Technology, she started her career as a game developer, a natural leader with direct responsibilities for day-to-day management of technical teams and client engagement. Edie leads projects from discovery to deployment and many touch points in between, including scrum ceremonies and backlog grooming, which I'll be asking about later. Edie's experience includes development and project management from ground floor startups all the way to Fortune 500 companies. Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Show, Edie.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's get into that because, you know, it is something that I have a client that I've been working with. I mean, I'm also an investor in it, but I've been helping him launch his company. And, you know, pre-COVID, he had developed these algorithms. When he finally got the patents on them, he was for artificial intelligence and machine learning. He developed, you know, and he's a scientist. It's for the scientific marketplace. And so he did what he does, which goes out to get peer review from these other scientists that would be using this, that it did what he said his algorithms were going to do with it comes to this software and data mining and things like that. And he proved it. He actually even did a user test on it as well. But it wasn't sexy. It wasn't pretty. It was really just functional. And so he took a video of it because he did not design it to scale. He designed it to prove that the algorithms work. And then now that he's been raising capital, he keeps getting pushback because the 2-minute video that shows it working isn't enough for a lot of them. And, you know, he's gone through an in-depth design model of how this is going to work and all that kind of stuff. The GUI stuff would still get worked out, but it's just really been kind of frustrating because we're like, that seems like it's an MVP, but it's not actually an MVP. And Edie's going to share with us now, like, what is the difference and why has it become such a challenge in this? Used to be valuations were the friction that you had between startups and their potential first round investors. And now it seems like, what do you have to prove that your idea will actually work before you can get money? And it's sort of a chicken and egg that I don't know. So tell us, Edie, tell us about, you know, why it's become such a challenge. And for those that don't necessarily know those terms, what is the difference between what I like back in the day, wireframe with some a PowerPoint, almost like a storyboard of what it was going to look like, was kind of how people would do. And then it had to be something functional. And then it had to be, you know, so talk about that and help our audience, the investors and the entrepreneurs listening, to understand the differences. And then we'll get into why is it such a challenge for startups.
Sure. So let's start with what an MVP is, right? We all know the acronym MVP, minimum viable product. Over the past 10, 15 years, we've seen that really become, give me something functional. Well, just because it's functional doesn't mean it's scalable, right? So what I tell people is you haven't built a MVP, you've built a prototype, which is great for the proof of concept, right? Prototypes are used for proof of concepts to make sure the idea has worked. And I think founders sometimes throw around that MVP because they don't understand that what they're saying is, it's become such a buzzword, right?
Yeah.
And it's setting up an expectation that prototype that you've built is never going to be able to fill. And I think investors have become so used to hearing that MVP. They're like, give me that MVP, give me the MVP. Well, if it were a true MVP, then they probably wouldn't be coming to ask you for capital, or the terms would be very different.
Right.
So when you have that prototype, you know, that proof of concept, is this going to work? But investors have become more demanding with, they want something that they can, if it's an app, they want it on their phone. They want to be able to download it and they want to be able to look at it. And that's where it becomes kind of tricky, right? Because to actually build out that sexy looking UI that everybody wants takes a lot of time and effort and engineering work, which is a very expensive these days. So what I usually tell my startups is get a good UI UX person, or I can provide you with one, and let's build out a Figma prototype. And that is Figma. And there's another company called Invision, Invision. And it will allow investors to actually download something onto their phones or view it via a web app. And they're able to play around with the flow of your application and kind of drill in and dig into however deep you want it to go. So it kind of gives them the feeling that they're buying into something that is fully thought out without the founders having to expend the capital to build that out fully.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense. So do people still even do wireframes anymore?
Yes, they still do. So typically the wireframing comes in much earlier than the Figma prototype. And actually you can do wireframing in Figma. So that's usually where it starts, is getting the flow of the application. What's the user experience going to be? And then it's more of a wireframe, very, you know, chicken scratch looking graphics. And then the UI UX person will go in and build, you know, the colors and the rounded buttons and all the things that make their heart sing. And, you know, not developer art like I make.
Right.
and they will build it out. So you start with that wireframe, which is just essentially the flow of the user's experience. And then that then becomes the groundwork for something like a Figma prototype or an Invision prototype.
Okay. So, because one of the things that we were talking earlier, you know, and the cost of engineers, you know, the lack of skills, I mean, partially probably because of limits on immigration, all kinds of things we've had like in Atlanta and the Southeast, you've had this, you know, growth of technology hubs that has driven up the price of good software engineers. And so to get to an actual functional product, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not $1 million. And the thing I was concerned about, I heard about that and kind of hit me, that is that, and then you also don't if you're bootstrapping that because you haven't been able to get the capital from a seed stage, you know, an initial round, founders round or something. Well, sometimes don't you run the risk of not having enough customer engagement in order to know that it is going to deliver the function that a customer is expecting? You know, the whole idea of growth hacking, because you're like getting iterations and, you know, figuring this out from customers as you're rolling it out, seems like that would be, you know, it's almost, you might have to back up and redo stuff and spend more money to fix something that's a viable product, but it's not a sellable product.
Right. So one thing that has really become another one of these buzzwords is just-in-time development, right? or testing by testing, iteration testing or whatever.
Yeah.
That's great when you're a Fortune 500 company that has the resources to expend. It is not great when you're a startup and you don't have, you know, you can barely scrap together a dev team, which by the way, you're going to be spending, you know, $1 million or more a year on. And it's not reasonable to think that you're going to be able to have all this testing development or whatever. And additionally, what I've seen also is that sometimes people become way too enveloped in the A/B tests. You know, A/B tests are kind of a dirty word for me. I know the value of them. I do data analytics. I understand. But sometimes the founders see a vision beyond what their customers can see. And when you're doing that iterative development, which we see a lot, it's, you know, you have to make a decision. Are you going to go with what the crowd wants? Or are you going to push it ahead because you think that ultimately that is where you need to go? And that's the decision that we, you know, you have to have somebody who's talking you through all of that, and the cost of all of that. Because it is expensive. These, especially in the Southeast, we've seen development costs rise significantly, especially due to a lot of these Silicon Valley and New York companies coming in and sniping our talent. And they can get those New York salaries and still live in, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Georgia, like I do. Yeah. So it's a much more valuable proposition for me, or for engineers in general. So again, getting to that MVP is going to be $1 million ordeal, or near about. And most people can't afford that. And again, what that MVP is, it may be scalable, right? And like you were saying, but it may not be sellable. It may not have all the features that you need to differentiate it from other products.
So with that is when you're creating your wireframe or else the map, I forget the term you use, where you kind of, you flush out how it's going to get developed and the process or like the project plan or something like that. Is that?
We have a project plan, and then we have, we can do like a, oh goodness, now you're making me forget. Like project requirements, like PRDs, project requirement documents, and project plans, right? So when you're building out those two, that will help fill in the backlog so you can see where the product is going to go over time. And so when I'm working with startups, you know, a lot of them will come in, they have a billion different features that they want for their application. And right. I have to tell them, all right, yes, give me $1 billion and I can build those billion ideas.
All at the same time.
All at the same time. Yes, great. But it's not realistic. It's not going to happen, right? So we have to scale it back to what they really want. Like, you know, and sometimes it even takes a matter of actually listing them in order that they want and looking at what proceeds to next, what has to happen before we build that feature out. And that's where you get into like building out a backlog, but all that should be in a project plan. And project plans, I think, is something that is a valuable tool that I think every investor needs to look at. They need to look at how this is going to be built, because I've seen it more times than not. You know, people get started and the lack of organization and the lack of clear direction leads a lot of money burning, right?
Yeah. Well, so go ahead.
I was just going to say, so having that clear vision, and it's okay to tweak that division. And it's even okay to go, you know, out of left field on that vision, but understand that there are economic or, you know, financial impacts to that and deadline impacts to that as well that need to be fleshed out with whomever your investors are as a founder.
I think I had an aha moment when you were talking there is like, by and large, a lot of investors don't really, they want to see financials, but they don't ever really believe the financials because when there's a company, it's a startup, there's really no way to predict 5 years down the road what it's going to look like, right? I mean, and you know, maybe you could get within the 24 months because you've got real time, you know what your costs are, you can kind of know how much you'll be able to sell. You know, that's the reason why they hate the things that are like the hockey sticks when they just do a percentage of they do, but because what they really want to know, and this is where they come into this all the time of what's your addressable market. Now it's like every time you got those three circles, your total market, addressable market, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? They really want to know. They've gotten more into, do you understand who your customer is and why they're going to buy, right? And mm-hmm. and then they look at sort of on the financials, it's more of like, well, does this entrepreneur know enough to know that their salaries are going to grow, right? And they're going to have to add in, like, you know, a software case, they're going to have to add in customer service, and they're going to have to add this stuff in. And so as they grow and that stuff grows, they're going to have to add this stuff. And so are they don't care as much about the numbers as they care about, do you know, do you have the right set of expectations and basic knowledge? And so just hearing you describe this, it almost seems that the investors that invest in software haven't yet made the shift to say, well, I don't want an MVP. I'd like to have a rough idea of what it's going to look like. And then your project requirement document that addresses your user addressable market. So, you know what I mean? To me, that's sort of like that's the perfect little tongue and groove of what really will make a software become successful in its design and ultimate outcome.
Right. And that like the project requirements and the product roadmap, I mean, that looks years into the future. Like you can push that out as far as you like. Right. So obviously it's going to be a much larger document, but you can map out, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And then at this point, you know, we're going to need to start adding internal tools to manage that customer service staff and to manage, you know, the slew of accountants that we're going to need or, you know, whatever it is, right. You start looking at, okay, this is a product that's going to the customers, but you can also plan out down the road, what internal tools are you going to need to help scale that product even further, right? Because ultimately, all of these software products, they end up having some sort of internal tools for people to manage it on the day-to-day. So what do those look like? And that's something that gets addressed, especially for the MVP, addressed of what all needs to be there to make it work for the average employee working that's not building the software, but managing the customers through the software. That's definitely a shift that I would really like to see more. I was a game developer originally, so I have an affinity for a lot of the older games, right? A lot of the horrible 64-bit graphics where everything is a triangle. And I liken it to now people are expecting like real life virtual experiences. Well, those are billion-dollar games, right? Not everyone is going to have the ability to build out that kind of thing. And ultimately, a lot of those games really kind of stink. So, you know, it's the older games that have the story and everything else in it and the music that kind of create this atmosphere. Well, tying that back into software, it's the idea and where you're taking it and the content in it and the team building it. Not the shiny little, you know, shiny MVP, right? Yeah. That has all the sexy UI and UX. That's just you know, you can swap that out for anything, right? Yeah. But the core of the application is what really matters. And I think, and it's a very visual trend I've been seeing, is it's very much visual, where they want to see something like physically in their hands, or some very beautiful transition of like a working product. But
yeah,
ultimately a lot of that can be faked, right? And it's, as long as you're upfront as a founder with those investors, that this is, you know, this is a Figma prototype, this is how it's going to look in the future or whatever. You know, don't try to say it's like a live thing that they can go to, but
right.
Giving them that little shiny object for them to be able to play with and understand helps. But I wish it wasn't a necessary requirement, because it is very difficult and time consuming even to build that. But it's much more manageable for the, especially bootstrap startup, than building a full application that eventually when they build these prototypes, most of them have to be thrown away.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So it's a waste of money and resources and everything. So I want to come back to a point you just made about the other software that needs to get developed. And I'm thinking, so are you talking about, because this was another of my aha moments, and my listeners out there always, hopefully you're having the same aha moments as I am, but so would it be developing a software that says that one, I mean, there's probably, you know, where do they click on the screen? So it's like behind the scenes. So you know that the thing that you want them to do with the application, they're not doing it because maybe they don't understand it, right? And so you can monitor that. And when they get like the little help thing pops up, well, I don't know where to find this or find that, or I don't know how to do this, then that gets integrated into future versions that will modify in order to address the feedback that they're getting while somebody's using the app. Is that the kind of stuff you're talking about?
So that would be more user experience type things. And that usually gets fleshed out through like a test group, or and especially when you look at some of these larger applications, there's usually a corporate partner that will go through and do that's when you start getting into beta testing, right? So okay. if your users are having a problem with knowing how to operate your application, then that's a user experience problem. This should be intuitive. So, you know, you might have to go back to the drawing board and revamp how your front end works or your user workflows, right? Another thing I would say is there are third-party softwares, which I adore, that allow your users to put in feature requests and bug tickets. That go directly into your backlog. Of course, you'd need somebody to monitor those and groom them and combine the duplicates and everything like that. But it gives your users a way of kind of giving you product feedback on the fly in a manageable way. Because, you know, you're going to get feedback that's outlandish, right? You're going to get stuff that you're like, what were they on when they submitted this ticket? Because it makes no sense. So you have to have somebody that monitors through that. So typically that's not going to happen in an MVP stage. That's going to happen in the growth stage, but it also will, the software is really cool. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I have it on a list of my preferred softwares to use, but, it will actually give like a product roadmap type thing page for your users, so they can see what you're actively developing and working on. So you have that two-way communication of, hey, we've heard you. We're working on it, and it's going to be released around this date, right? So there's a lot of things you can do for like the bug fixes and things of that nature. And again, I would say if you're having problems with users understanding how to work your application, then you're going to need to bring on some more user experience.
Yeah. So is that list? I mean, so I want to remind people again that Edie's website is keyboarder.com, K-E-I-B-O-A-R-D-E-R. Do you have that list there, like Edie recommends, or is there a blog?
I do not. Maybe I should. Maybe I should go do that.
Or, you know, they can go, if they want that list, they could go and fill out your contact form.
They could.
And you
I would be more than happy to provide it.
Yeah, there you go. See, that's a good thing, right? So yep. Let's roll over into, like, I'm actually curious because I think there's opportunity to talk about what you specifically do over at Keyboarder and why did you start that? Why did you leave doing all these fun game stuff to go, you know, become a service to this wonderful world of startups and helping them navigate getting launched?
Sure. Well, I played too many video games when I was young, and I became a game engineer. That's what originally brought me to the Atlanta area. I worked on quite a few games from all sorts of platforms. I did console, mobile, desktop applications, or games. Eventually, though, around the time that I was growing in my engineering experience, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for that middle level engineer in Atlanta for software game developers. So out of the blue, I got offered a job for a startup in transportation. And I became the sole engineer of that startup for 2 years. It wasn't a game startup. It was, again, transportation. And when I really got into it, I really loved it. not to mention it paid a little bit better. so then I moved into, you know, I was managing all aspects of that application, managing contractors, you know, managing other engineers, et cetera, the ones that were there anyway. And eventually I realized that the startup wasn't going to get off the ground. So I started looking for another position and kind of stumbled into services, right? I did not want to go work for another startup because I felt like it was not where I wanted to be. The chaos, I needed a little break from the chaos for a little bit. so I started working in services and it really grew out of my engineering background. I grew more into the product management, project management, client management. And one of my clients was a Fortune 500 fintech company. And I just really loved it. So essentially what brought me to founding Keyboarder earlier this year was because I am an engineer, I get asked to do a lot of engineering work. And although I do it and I still love it, it is not where I find the most of my happiness in my day to day. So I kind of kept getting pigeonholed into being, you know, oh, great, you know, come manage this project. And can you tack on some of these tickets too? And it just wasn't working for me. It was too much to handle. So, yeah, I started Keyboarder so I could, you know, give back to other startups. I've lived a life. I've done it. I understand. I've also been on the other end of it and lived through a lot of mistakes and a lot of headaches that were completely avoidable. and, you know, giving back some of that wisdom to the community and helping them get and helping businesses who have made it through some of that, who are going into scaling, get to where they are scaling. Yeah. Right. Because that is a pivotal time in business. Everybody talks about the building out an MVP and getting the product launched. That's easy peasy when it comes to scale. Scale is where it makes or breaks you. So you see the mighty fall in the scale period. And it may not even be about the product. It's about the processes around getting the product to market that cause a lot of the problems. Yeah.
Right. That scalable thing is, I do a lot of talks on that. People that listen on a regular basis would understand that. And that's, I think, where we can roll into sort of talking about these growing pains that you help companies overcome that software related, because either they, like a lot of times, and one of the guys I interviewed not too long ago talked about we're identifying the bottlenecks in how decisions are made, how, you know, a customer order is handled, it's billed or it's delivered, or all the different pieces that's part of what the company is doing, and how entrepreneurs are onboarded. I mean, how the employees are onboarded, all of those things that are part of the running of a company. And sometimes people start out where they're just doing it, you know, using whatever tool, or it's just manual because it's small, it's easy enough to walk over to another. And we found that with people now so much remote as a result of the pandemic, that like you mentioned at the beginning, they need to get these automation tools. And then they, you know, they might have had one, and then they got to figure out how to hook it up and hand off data to another app or something. And so, you know, it's what would be the questions that they would be saying to themselves, or the statements they would be saying to themselves that could then, if they're listening right now, would be like, oh, I experienced that. I guess I need software for that. What's the kind of things that your clients say, this is what was happening, and I finally knew I had to go do something?
From a software perspective, especially, I hear I deploy more hot fixes than I do releases, right? That's a big one. My features aren't rolling out as fast as I would like. And it's usually due to some sort of software architecture that is off. For the other parts of the process, it's, you know, looking at employees' time. Like my employees who are, you know, finance guys are spending too much time onboarding somebody. They're spending too much time doing X, Y, and Z. They're not spending their time doing the expertise that I hired them for.
Okay.
Or I found this great piece of software and I really want to use it, but it doesn't work with anything that I have. Right. Because there's a lot of companies that already have built-in integrations where it's just click, click, you know, and all your stuff moves around between systems, but there's a lot of great products out there that don't have those. And if you're looking at yourself saying, I need to be able to bring on more people quicker because my product is growing and I need more of a certain type of person, or I'm spending too much time, you know, filling out not financial statements, but like, you know, billing hours and things of that nature. How can I bring that? It's the general everyday running of a business that it's not, there are stuff of it that's hard.
Yeah.
A lot of it is tedious.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes a company will think that they're going to become more efficient because they centralize something, they kind of roll it all up and they take it out of the field or whoever was doing it. And then all of a sudden those people become really, really frustrated because the thing that they would take them a day to get done, you know, or in a 24-hour cycle, now it might take 4 or 5 days because it's centralized. And right. it might be because they're sending the information by an email because they're not able to input it directly. So there might be just a thing of creating a integrated Google form that they submit the information the same way that it would go into the form, and they could still be centralized, but, you know, things like that, they don't. And I think it comes where companies get into a problem with that is if they don't have open communication up and down their line of their organization to know where there's a bottleneck like that.
Right. And also when we're looking at cross company or cross, what is the name for it?
Interdiscipline or?
Silos, like you have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cross silo, you know, your marketing teams and finance team, your development team. What I like to do, and I can send this to anybody that wants to fill out on my contact form, I actually have a diagram of how all these different products that I use for software development, how they integrate into one singular node, right? One brainchild, which for me in software development is Jira. Have key people in those different silos make a chart of the different products that they're using and look at what overlaps, right? Maybe it's not even a matter of bring it all into one central location. It is more about, you know, making sure that this information over here goes to this department over here in a seamless manner.
Yeah.
Process so having and flow. Having that diagram of like the actual products will then let you understand what all different types of areas each department needs. And if you're going to look at building a custom solution, right, what are you going to have to integrate with in order to make that transition? Or you know, what how much of that you're actually going to be able to, and how much of it you're going to have to keep.
Yeah.
And having appointees. So one thing I'm really big on is if you have the responsibility and you have the authority, right? No response without authority.
Right.
Appointing people in those departments that you trust to make decisions on behalf of the department and having the buy-in on their end, because that really, having those stakeholders and having an advocate for whatever additional solution you're about to build or bring in will help with the adoption of it. That's usually the hardest part. The hardest part is not building it. The hardest part is getting people to actually use it and to see the value in it in themselves. And that usually requires some sort of advocate in the department level who is very well.
Yeah. All right. Well, in the few minutes that we have left here, I've learned a lot. I had my aha moments. That's really good, man. You're giving away free prizes. So I think that the diagram one, I think I need to get that, because that will, I could definitely use that when I talk to companies. But I said at the beginning that I would come back and ask you about, I think I figured out backlog grooming. It's not how you are, if you've got the party in the front and business in the front, party in the back, hairdo, what do they call those things? It's not that mullet. Kind of grooming. Yeah, it's not mullet grooming. It's your backlog of fixes, right? So scrum ceremony. Now, when I was in college, I was a huge fan of rugby, but I don't think that's the same use of scrum, right? So that's a scrum ceremony.
So it's a different type of, it's a agile process, right? Okay. So it's an implementation of the agile work. So you have daily stand-ups, you have, you know, sprints, right? So breaking up work into manageable time sections. And part of that manageable time section is going through things that need to get done and prioritizing them so you can dedicate it to a certain amount of time in the cycle. So you can see how much you have to develop. You can kind of get an idea of how long it takes to build similar items and forecast out how long it's going to take to build everything in your backlog. And grooming is just going through with the project stakeholders and product developers or product engineers and making sure that everything is prioritized correctly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, see, I knew that there was something really, unfun about scrum ceremony and backlog grooming, but, you know, thank you for explaining that. Anything that we forgot to talk about that you want to talk about before we say our goodbyes?
No, it was lovely being here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I've enjoyed having you on the show, Edie, and look forward to seeing you again at our next entrepreneur event that we're going to probably be to within the next couple of weeks. So remember, everybody, go to keyboarder.com, KEIBOARDER.com. And get into the contact page and get the valuable information from Edie. And please, you'll hear a little, if you're listening on a podcast, you'll hear an exit, some other information at the end of this. But I want to encourage you to go to KarenRands.co, my website, and sign up for our video tips for entrepreneurs raising capital and investors investing in entrepreneurs. It's questions that I've answered over the years for entrepreneurs in a 1 to 2 minute video.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, The Compassionate Capitalist Show, brought to you by Cougaran Capital Holdings with Karen Rands as host. You are encouraged to visit the website, cougaran.com, to learn more about how Karen and her team help investors and angel groups make money by avoiding investing in deals that suck, and how the Cougaran Capital companies and partners help entrepreneurs break through their barriers to capital and live their dream by building companies that can scale and create generational wealth for their founders and investors. If your business could benefit from exposure to our audience of business executives, entrepreneurs, and investors, we are seeking financial partners and sponsors for the Compassionate Capitalist Show to help us take this podcast beyond our 150,000 listeners and amplify the message of the Compassionate Capitalist movement by making this a top 50 business podcast. The Compassionate Capitalist Show is available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and Google Podcasts. Contact us at KarenRanz.co to learn more. And as a listener, you can do your part of the Compassionate Capitalist movement by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts and sharing this show with your friends and colleagues. Be sure to pick up your copy of Karen's bestseller that launched the Compassionate Capitalist Movement, Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, a step-by-step strategies to leverage private equity investment for passive wealth creation. Thank you for listening.